You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hey, good morning. You're here for another episode of The View. This is our monthly chance to catch up with folks with the Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism group. So I'm delighted to say we have three folks today from Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism. Carlton Elliott Smith coming to us today from Mississippi, Kenny Wiley from Denver, and Leslie Mack, I forgot to ask where you are. You're home in Michigan,
Grand Rapids. I'm home for a few weeks, actually. I'm home. So
all right. And did you actually get a sabbatical, or was that a dream?
Well, I slept a lot, so that's a plus. So, yeah.
Good. That's great. Well, let's start with you. We just went through Martin Luther King weekend, and I know the whole Reclaim MLK effort was underway. What do you think?
Yeah, it was really great. I know I wanted to talk a little bit just about the concept of Reclaim MLK and kind of the evolution of it, because I think it's really important for people to know the trajectory of the movement and the growth that it has, you know, year over year and month over month. So Reclaim MLK was actually started last year, so MLK 2015, and it was a weekend that organizers and activists across the country looked to kind of take back the message of MLK and this notion of what we should be doing. I think the message, of course, of MLK has been distorted, and also the purpose of the holiday had been distorted into this idea of service and what that means. And so last year we spent a lot of time crafting different messages and a different way to celebrate the holiday and really taking action in our communities and challenging the status quo in many areas, which was really amazing, wonderful. I actually was part of a Reclaim MLK action in Philadelphia. We had a huge march and some amazing speeches and a really great effort of bringing folks together, organizations together that hadn't happened previously. So building on that for the last, gosh, I think maybe 2 months or so, eight weeks or so, organizers nationwide have been meeting together once a week to kind of discuss what this year's Reclaim MLK will look like. And so the concepts that we brought together were this general message of divest and invest. And so we wanted to really bring home the idea of pushing the narrative of Reclaim MLK a little further than we had pushed it the previous year. And so Saturday we saw actions that were meant to draw attention to institutions and systems that have failed and continue to hurt Black people. And we saw lots of amazing actions in that. We saw in Chicago the taking over of a police credit union in Chicago. We saw lots of amazing actions. And then on Monday, we look to shine a light on the resilient and strategic way we can build our community, protect one another, and inspire our people. And we saw amazing actions. We saw in the Bay Area, the Bay Bridge was shut down by an amazing collective of LGBT, mostly women, out there in the Bay. We saw in Denver the complete taking over of normally, I guess I'll put it strategically, commercialized, I guess that's a good way of putting it, commercialized march for MLK, and we saw activists completely take over the entire spirit, message, and space of that action, which was beautiful to see. Just amazing actions across the country, and I think it's really important that we highlight these things, because what we'd like to see is our communities, our UU communities, our UU congregations doing that same thing and having growth and having movement, so that we're not hearing the same types of sermons, the same types of messaging, the same types of music all across the board at our congregations every year, because we want to see growth. We want to say, okay, we said these things last year, and what have we done in a year to build on that? What have we done to push this narrative further? What have we done to lift up this message and this fight for Black liberation further in the last year? And so I just wanted to highlight those things and make sure that people are aware of them. People can go to reclaimmlk.com to read a lot more about the concepts that were presented. And I was lucky enough to be on all those calls with these organizers nationwide, and I can't even say enough about how impressive and brilliant, and I mean, I literally just sat and listened every week. I didn't have much to contribute because they're much smarter and more clever than I am. But what they've come up with and the details that are there are really amazing. So wanted to lift that up for folks.
You did that from a variety of different groups in the different cities?
Yeah, it was definitely a concerted effort. And so the first calls that we had were strategic calls. So we kind of went to target large cities and contacts we already had, some through many different organizations, Black Lives Matter. And the Blackout Collective was a big spearheading force through that. And also M4BL, which I'm a part of, was also a big part of that as well. So the first couple of calls were kind of like, okay, we know these people personally, and so we're going to invite them into the convo. And then from there, kind of having those folks bring other people within their networks and in their cities to the table, and kind of grew from there. And so there was a combination of public events, which would be events that people would know about ahead of time and we wanted to get the general public involved with, and then obviously some more covert actions and operations that were a little close to the vest and not aware of until they were sprung on folks when they occurred. So it was a really amazing collaboration process. We had a legal team that was involved in kind of consulting with everybody on the actions they were planning. We had a communications team creating images and content and press releases and everything for all of them. So it really was kind of about putting together a cohesive message that we could promote and continue to build on leading up to MLK Day and then beyond that.
It's really amazing to watch how local these things are and then the support. I just really see such a creative use of media and communication that couldn't have happened, I think, even 5 years ago.
So it can't work. Absolutely. I mean, I think, again, that's part of the growth of a movement like this, where we're looking to make sure that we're progressing further, that we're bringing more people into the fold, and that we're creating lasting connections so that we can continue to work together and have a cohesive message going forward. This movement is so much about bringing what your individual talents are to the movement and using them in any way you can. And part of that is connecting folks and making sure that we're all pooling those resources together, really using them in an effective way. So. Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, it was hard to be out of Minneapolis. I know a bunch of stuff went on there, and I wasn't there. But yeah, it's really exciting. You know, I should have said in the beginning, we had our first meeting showing up for Racial Justice, a group to really mobilize white people around these issues, and 182 people showed up on Saturday. We thought maybe 50, 60, and it was amazing. So I see this movement has generated so much energy. It's really exciting. Carlton, where have you been in all of this? What are you up to with Reclaim MLK?
Well, I had the great privilege of being the speaker this past Sunday at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in New London, Connecticut, with our colleague Carolyn Paterno, colleagues Carolyn Paterno and Caitlin O'Brien. That was a really wonderful occasion to be there. They have a tradition that they started fairly recently where they have two services on Sunday morning, and between the two services they have a large Black Lives Matter banner that's in the sanctuary that has the name of the congregation across the bottom of it. And between the two services, they take it out to the street, and they go out in front of their large sign in front of the church and take the banner and sing and wave at the people who are passing by and show their solidarity that way, and then take the banner back inside. So I really appreciate the solidarity that we are receiving from the good folks in New London, Connecticut. And I preach. Ooh, my phone's ringing. Hang on one second. Let me decline this. So the thing that I really appreciated about being able to be there on the King holiday was to have another opportunity to reflect on his legacy. And it's easy to get stuck in doing kind of like the same thing every year and saying the same things every year, which I think is what Leslie was pointing to. So every time I have a chance to speak about Dr. King, I'm looking to see how I can look at his legacy, look at his contribution from a different angle. And for me this year, it was in past years, for example, one year it was looking at it from the angle of the Dreamers and the Dream Act. This is when that was very much in our consciousness about 5 or 6 years ago. And this year I was really looking at his legacy as an artist, and particularly as a performance artist. Someone who, like the folks who are involved in Black Lives Matter now, who are doing performance in the public sphere, in the Mall of America, on the Bay Bridge in California, all over the country, that there's something to be said for the fact that all of our lives are performance and that we're always performing all the time, and some people respond differently to the performance of our duties. I would venture to say that the police officers who choked Eric Garner on the streets of Staten Island were doing what? They were performing their duties. They were acting in a public space inside of their role. So I would make the case that just as Dr. King was an artist and creating experiences, that we also have the opportunity in our daily lives to create experiences for people and do what we say in our hymn, Spirit of Life. We all have the opportunity to give life the shape of justice, as Dr. King did. So that is something that I've been working with.
Sorry,
the other thing that I...
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
I'm sorry, I missed that. That sounds like a great sermon.
It came together nicely. I mean, and when you're in a room where there's such a great sense of community, like at All Souls in New London, Connecticut, and with my wonderful colleagues, Carolyn and Caitlin, it just all came together quite nicely. I was very glad to be there. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I've been reflecting on more recently is the fact that this summer at General Assembly, we'll be observing the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's 1966 Ware Lecture. He was the Ware Lecture is the main lecture that happens at General Assembly every year. It's been going on for more than 100 years now, and it's an opportunity for us to hear from people, usually from people in our larger world. Cornel West spoke last year. This year is going to be Krista Tippett, who does the Sunday morning program on NPR, on Being is the program that she does. So we have these people from the wider world who come to speak. And in 1966, which would have been 3 years after the March on Washington in 1963 and 2 years before Dr. King's assassination in Memphis at the Lorraine Motel, Dr. King came and spoke to Unitarian Universalists at General Assembly on the theme of Don't Sleep Through the Revolution. And in his Ware lecture, he did a comparison of today's, of the times, Christian folks and Christian ministers and people of faith in general did a comparison between them and Rip Van Winkle, who went to sleep under King George and woke up 20 years later under the presidency of George Washington. So he missed the whole revolution. And Dr. King challenged Unitarian Universalists at the time not to sleep through the revolution, to stay woke, to go to the vernacular, as we would say it today, but to stay awake and to be an active participant in bringing about change. And so I encourage everyone who has the opportunity to check that out online. If you type in King 1966 Ware, W-A-R-E, the whole transcript will pop up very readily. So it's a great time to be reflecting on this legacy. The other thing that comes to mind for me is our colleague, ministerial colleague, Rosemary Bray McNack, a few years back. She's now the president of Star King School for the Ministry, wrote an article for the UU World about a conversation she had with Coretta Scott King about why she and Dr. King did not become Unitarian Universalists back in the 1960s, although they were very much in solidarity and aligned with Unitarian Universalist principles, probably even more so than with Baptist principles and ideas. But the reason was is because she knew that because he and she knew they weren't going to be able to build a strong black base as Unitarian Universalists. So they made the political move as well as a theological move to remain solidly inside the African American community, the African American Christian community, from which they could build that base that, of course, transformed the landscape of what was possible in the U.S. around racialized identity. So much to think about this week of Dr. King's birth.
I mean, dwelling on Rosemary's piece a bit, there's so many, I mean, I keep rereading that, and every time I do, I see it anew. There's the practical, political reality of building a base. And then I think there's the theology to build the base. And I, lately I've been really wondering if UU theology holds the ability to build that base as well as the politics. Have you thought about that? I mean, do you think it was theological as well as political, or?
So I would take it this direction, and I should mention that we have the Black Lives Track that's coming up in General Assembly this year in Columbus. One of the things we're going to be covering is anti-blackness in a global context, and we can say that the United States definitely was founded on an anti-black foundation, on an anti-black platform. And our Unitarian Universalist tradition is no exception to that rule. How could it be? You know, having been started a few years after the American Revolution with some of the very same power players involved in that pushing it forward. So I would say that the theology, there's so many thoughts that are running through my mind now. Some folks have talked about the white woman's Christ and the black woman's Jesus, where there's sort of like reverence for the title of Christ for white women, where there's reverence for the personal relationship with Jesus that happens for black women. So I say that to say I think that we come into religious life with a radically different experiences and different needs. And a lot of that has to do with how we are socialized based on our racialized identities. And as I was saying, we had a big meeting of our congregational life staff nationally in Boston last week. And as I said to some of my colleagues there, based on how we are perceived or what our racialized identities are in U.S. context, we're going to have different experiences both inside the church and, you know, by the time we step outside on the street and somebody's trying to catch a cab or just trying to get peacefully from the church to their home. We're going to have some of us are more likely to be stopped and frisked than others are. And so I'd say to the extent that Unitarian Universalist theology represents that of the ruling class of its origin, which was based on the needs of land-owning wealthy white men at the beginning, and we've had, you know, centuries of disenfranchisement before that and centuries of disenfranchisement after that, that there's a way in which the theology, the principles are, I'd say, are solid, and the way that they're lived out is different based upon where we stand. I'd say that one of the things I noticed this past week is Stephen Colbert had DeRay McKesson, one of the activists in the Atlanta area, I believe, on his show recently, and he exchanged seats with DeRay as a sign of solidarity with Black Lives Matter. But he also said in that conversation, well, you know, and he asked DeRay, what can I do about my privilege? And Stephen Colbert said, even before DeRay could respond to that, I'm not giving up my money, and I'm not giving up my show. So he made that very clear up front. But it points to the fact that I think a lot of people want things to work out and the tables to turn without actually making the sacrifice of giving up things that are dear to them or trying to level the playing field a bit. And I think that's where our theologies diverge to, that some of us who are empowered and want to stay that way, and some of us who have been disempowered and want to see the things leveled out a bit. But those are somewhat divergent intentions.
Yeah, thank you. Kenny, you wrote quite a piece on Facebook that has got hundreds of people in conversation, as you often do. It's inspiring to see the way that you do that. But you talked about a youth conference that you were at. Do you want to share that story with us and talk about what you've made of it?
I'm certainly interested to have a conversation about what went down. So, yeah, you're right. It kind of flew around UU Facebook land. And so what happened was, as part of, you know, an annual tradition, there's the MLK Justice Con held in Denver. And the reason it's held in Denver is because every Monday, every MLK day, every Monday, there's a what we call in Denver the Marade, and it's march and parade that has tended to feel more like a parade, I guess, in the sense of, I'm not sure how serious it's been, but so the YouthCon starts Saturday afternoon, and this year the focus was explicitly on racial justice, on Black Lives Matter, and so a group of adults and youth wrote curriculum about the history of race and racism in this country before it was a country, and all the way up until all the way up until where we are now. And what was really fascinating was over the course of Sunday, as our youth started to hear about that there was this Reclaim MLK action going on in Denver, and that there would be a sort of, I've been trying to think of the right word, but an alternate option for marching that ended up taking over the parade itself, which usually has somewhere between 15 and 25,000 people. And so there was the question of several of the youth wanted to be part of that reclaiming, and that because they were moved by what they'd learned at other youth cons and what they were learning at this one as well. And so, there were about 70, 75 youth and eight youth of color, and several of whom identify as biracial, and several of whom, grew up with mostly white friend groups, and in some cases in white families. And what was so interesting was the details of how kind of became the largest conversation, in the sense of there were youth and adults, white youth and white adults especially, who felt like we shouldn't do it unless everybody wanted to, because there was some risk. I mean, it's technically breaking the law, right? And the march in a way that's, the parade, all the main streets are blocked off and everything. And so it's obviously, those who work with youth know there are a ton of logistical questions. Can we even do this at all? All of these things. Well, several youth, white youth and youth of color, said basically we're doing it anyway, at which point several of us as adult advisors in the room felt like, okay, so they're going to do it whether we sanction it or not, so how do we support them? How do we help them do the work and ministry they're trying to do? And the group, so the white leadership, youth and adult, decided we needed a unanimous vote, that it was said that we wouldn't do it, at which point several, one youth of color in particular, a black girl from the state of Colorado, she said how disappointed she was in her, and that she felt like the group was willing to talk the talk but not walk the walk, in this case literally. I think the reason I wanted to bring this story, other than that it's just interesting in general, is because what happened when she said that, and she has been very up to date with Black Lives Matter, but what happened was so illustrative, I think, of the ways in which really well-intentioned white adults and youth can sometimes super get in the way, is that there's this way in which everybody congratulated her for how brave she was and thank you for sharing, and then like moved on, and like, all right, well, now we're going to go to whatever was next on the schedule. And as I felt and I looked at the faces of other youth of color there, it just became clear, okay, so if we don't address this, we're just going to move on and people are going to leave really wounded. And so what we did was, myself and two other adult advisors of color, we talked to the girl, and she...
Can I just pause for 1 minute?
Yeah.
And say, what a wonderful phrase it is to hear myself and a few other advisors of color.
Yeah, you're telling me.
There are so many of our conferences about which that phrase could not be uttered. So I just wanted to pause and like honor that little phrase that you slipped in.
Yeah. I think you're right, Meg. And that was so important, that there were three adult advisors of color that, and that's, we were able to, like, hold the space. And so what happened was I went one by one and approached the other youth of color, and all, and nearly all of them wanted to do a caucus. And, you know, without violating the trust of that space, what was so powerful was they, in one night, went from this sort of, well, I guess this is just kind of the way it is and the group's going to move on, to, wait, we can, you know, we have power and we need to tell our white youth and our white adults especially how they've hurt us this evening and what we'd like to see going forward. And so they led us, you know, I want to move into the discussion phase of this, but what they did was they led us to the space where they helped the adults see we don't have to all march in the same group, and that some folks, where they are, including one person of color, they wanted to be in the main march, and they also had a good time. And most of the youth, well over half, ended up marching in the unsanctioned march and just kept talking about how it was one of the most amazing moments of their lives to be with these Black Lives Matter activists and others, just like reclaiming space in the way that they had the night before, that Sunday late evening, as they talked for 2 hours in the caucus. And the last little bit of thing I wanted to say before we have a discussion about it is that when they picked four youth of color to talk to the white adults and to have myself and Jamil Scott sort of lightly facilitate that conversation. And what they said in that space was that what they needed wasn't to hear how inspiring they were. What they needed was sometimes, to the phrase I'll never forget, sometimes we need you to get in the way and sometimes we need you to get out of the way. And what they meant by that was sometimes they need you to get in the way of you know, of sort of racism and white supremacy and help us deal with these things, and then other times we need you to just get out of the way and support us because we know what we need. And that was just so so moving. So with that, it was their own reclaiming, you know. And there happened to be a sort of practice for Reclaim MLK in the same church at the same time. And so a lot of the folks I organized with, a lot of the Black Lives Matter Denver folks, were in the church, and three of them took time to join the caucus for about 45 minutes. And so the youth of color, these are like 14, 15, we don't even have any seniors. These were 14, 15, 16-year-olds asking these, you know, grown activists, like, how did you get to where you are? And just an incredible space. And it just spoke to the ways in which really, really well-intentioned, really, like, kind-hearted folks can sometimes really mess things up, but I just give everybody there a lot of credit that we worked through the pain and built something that honored where folks were and recentered, and those youth of color felt recentered.
First of all, Kenny, thank you so much for sharing. Sorry, Meg, is that okay if I talk? Okay. Thanks, first of all, for sharing that reflection both on Facebook and then coming to talk today. Most people don't know that behind the scenes, usually for these Black Lives of UU shows, we call an audible like the day before because something happened or something comes together and we feel moved to talk about something other than what we planned. And today was one of those days, and we really wanted to lift up the work that this youth did in Denver and also use it as a mechanism for discussing some larger issues within our faith and how youths of color often don't feel heard, not just in youth spaces, but in spaces generally speaking. And so I and all of us discussed it and thought it was really important to talk about this in this context since we had an hour to discuss it today. And one of the things in talking with Kenny away from this gaze here that really hit home for me was that this youth felt silenced. And I think that that's a really big piece that we need to discuss about how UUs of color feel silenced and this general push to calm things down, to put a bow on something, to stick to the schedule that gets elevated over actually having meaningful change and dialogue in a room. And so that, to me, it's a privilege there that needs to be set aside. The privilege is in compartmentalizing these issues and being able to flip the page and move on to something else because it's not something that affects you personally. So you can say, well, we'll go back to that. But if you're a person of color and it's hitting you right then, you don't have the option to flip the page. That's not a privilege we're afforded. And so I think it's really important that when we are in these spaces and trying to have these conversations that we look at what's being centered, look at the goals that are in place, and adjust accordingly. And I know that that's like the least UU thing ever because we like our schedules and we like our time to be done and we like to make sure we're hitting everything that we planned on hitting. But this work, as Kenny said in his Facebook post, is not hypothetical. It's real. It's real feelings, it's real people, and it's real situations that we're dealing with. And so I think that we need to add this human component back into the work that we do because it without it, it becomes meaningless. It becomes lip service. And it's really important that we highlight that and lift that up.
Yeah. And you know, the just to add to that is the you know, there are a lot of youth and adults worried about getting arrested. And I mean, understandably so, right? It's a scary thing, you know. And what the youth of color needed the rest of the group to hear is that they said, okay, so what I'm hearing is you don't feel safe. Welcome to our world, like, and you know, and that really just them having the space to say that in this way of asking folks to listen made a massive difference. And that was another, and another thing was just that they, the youth of color said, we want, you know, we want you to join us. We want you to join us and to support us instead of talking over us or telling us how brave we are, even as you do nothing. And that shift for folks was like, oh, wait, so I have to put something on the line too. And that the what they asked us, the three adults of color, to do, what the caucus asked of us, was to help the adults, the white adults, realize how much whenever they speak, because of the relationship between youth and adults, how much whenever they talk, how much weight that holds. And so to use that, to use those voices when needed and to not use them when needed. And that was really huge, too.
My observation has been that UUs are incredibly sophisticated at, like, a whole bag of, a toolbox of, like, right relations, consensus, you know, a very peace and oriented kind of social process. They're really good at managing meetings and so on like that, and it just becomes in the way of anything really happening. There's always this benevolent control coming from the center of the meeting that we're going to take up this issue, and then we're going to take up that issue, and then we're going to do this all in this way. It's somebody saying here on the side, Robert's Rules of Order. It's really not even Robert's Rules of Order. It's a kind of benevolent, everybody's going to have their space. Everybody's going to have their place. We're all going to agree. I'm questioning even the beginning there, why you got into a thing where everybody had to agree on, you know, a single course of action. That's like, you know, that's crazy town, if you ask me. You know, I mean, it's stuff like, especially when you're starting talking about a disruption to a mainstream co-opted, commercialized, was the word Leslie used, you know, event. You're going to disrupt something and you want everybody to agree. I mean, that's, how can you, couldn't build a way to cut off any possibility of change or action or any new leadership coming up. I mean, in some ways, Unitarian Universalists, you know, so many people, adults are in the helping professions, are therapists, have facilitated group therapy sessions and all these things. I mean, there's all of that kind of toolbox available, and it can be very controlling, very controlling. Yeah. And it's designed, Hank is going, are we afraid of conflict? We're working to keep conflict from happening.
Yeah.
Everything gets smoothed over.
That was the biggest thing was you could feel the tension in the room, and the white adults, and these are folks I've worked with since I moved to Denver, what they were working to do was have the conflict go away. And what Jamil and I told them was, no, this is exactly what we need. The idea that you couldn't get a unanimous vote on one sentence, right, in Unitarian Universalist Church. How are you going to get unanimous vote on joining this huge action? The conflict piece, the tension piece, the difficult emotion piece, that was stuff that there's just so much fear about. And so what they did was the silencing happened, not because anybody said the words, your voices don't matter. They just tried to smooth it over way before we were anywhere near needing to do that. We needed to sit in the room, sit in the awkwardness, sit in the silence, and ask ourselves hard questions.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder, one, Kenny, just hearing you speak, you know, the part of me wonders, like, it sounds like so much of just regular issues that teens have in our churches with adults of adults once again wanting to be peacemakers. I mean, what did Friedman, you know, the great sociologist and psychiatrist, talked about that if you have someone really creative and really, you know, amazing, the way to stymie them is to give them a boss who's a peacemaker, you know, and that will just kill it, you know, and sometimes I wonder, is it because we try to be so all-encompassing of all of these different theologies, all these different beliefs, and so the best way to deal with it is to not talk about it. You know, we like to give lip service to all this stuff, and because if we start talking about it, then things are going to come up, and maybe we're also afraid of disagreeing with our friends, and all of a sudden going like, oh my gosh, my friend believes something completely different from me, and so it's better if we just talk about having different beliefs, but don't actually engage in conversations about it too. So,
well, let's lift up that something different happened this time.
Yeah, right.
And that's the good news here, I think, is that the people were in the room, not just the advisors of color, but also some Black Lives Matter activists. I mean, that is going to change those kids' lives, I think, and how wonderful that is. Carl, are you trying to get in?
Yeah, I was going to say, bringing it back to Dr. King's legacy, one of the things that he talks about in his 1966 Ware lecture is encouraging everyone, people of good conscience, to be creatively maladjusted, which means that there are just some things in our culture and our society that we're just not going to be okay with, and we're going to find imaginative and creative ways to respond to it, just as Kenny is describing in the situation at the Marade. We should be creatively maladjusted to discrimination, to segregation, to police brutality. These are, and if we're not creatively maladjusted, then what are we? I'd say that we're destructively adjusted to these things. We've learned how to swallow our own silences. We've learned how to look the other way. And as Kenny points out, I think there's a light bulb that goes off when folks who identify as white find themselves on the other, you know, looking at the bubble from the angle of those of us who are not, that we're not feeling protected and safe and like the police are on our side. So I think that, you know, for as long as people are becoming aware, I hope that more and more people will become creatively maladjusted, as Dr. King suggested 50 years ago.
My experience...
Go ahead. Sorry.
Because I'm in the middle of an issue with that involved youth of color. One of them is my son and another youth at a fall conference here. And what I'm finding is with this idea of... First of all, there's no such thing as conflict avoidance. It happens, and it's much worse when it finally does. What I'm finding is this idea of conflict avoidance among white you use is actually a way of maintaining control. And so what happens is it's wanting to control the whole situation, not wanting to hold people accountable. And I have found myself, it's the story of my life, is when I keep saying something's wrong, something's wrong, something's wrong, I'm told, here's another tactic I will use, don't triangulate. So I said, I've been thinking about that. I've been told don't triangulate when I've tried to advocate for change or for accountability. And that's another form of control, is being told don't triangulate. And I And I've only heard, I will say, I've never heard it from my UU colleagues of color, ever. In fact, when I go to a colleague of color with an issue, there I'm heard, I'm given advice and guidance. If I try, some, not all, some white UUs will say to me, colleagues, well, don't triangulate. And I'm like, so I'm passionate right now because there's a white man called youth of, 3 out of the 4 youth of color got in trouble, toxic and bad. And I've now been fighting to get this person held accountable, and this person is very prominent in the youth community here in the Pacific Northwest, and he's untouchable. And I said, so the message is that basically if you are untouchable, if you are a white male who's been in youth community and adult, you could do and say whatever you want, and I'm the one who's being, you know, basically written off as the troublemaker. So I'm just, this is bringing up so much for me, Kenny, because there's no accountability if you are a white UU. We have to not have conflict. We have to work together. It's Joanna, you said it, trading integrity for tranquility.
Right. And I also often wonder if we as white Unitarian Universalists allow, like, the only people who are going to bring up conflict are people of color, and that we've sort of created this like a path, like, well, you know. We don't want to actually come into conflict with our other white colleagues. But look here, you know, here are our colleagues of color, and maybe we should listen to them. And it's sort of like it's culturally appropriate for them to be upset, but not for us. You know, it's also weird. I haven't thought it all through, but I just kind of keep seeing that over and over again. That here's this thing that happens.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I was at a conference this summer with. Tech and social justice people for like 5 days, and somebody in one of the presenters said, "Hey, you know, there's a huge massive movement happening now. What is it?" Like, posed to the whole group. There were maybe 13 people of color there out of, you know, 100 plus folks, and all of us, all the people of color, refused to say anything. We were just like, I'm not going to be the one to say the Black Lives Matter movement. And it was like silent for like 5 minutes where nobody said anything. And it was, you know, finally somebody said something, and it ended up being a woman of color. And I just immediately said, you know, I think it's really telling that you all waited for a person of color to say this thing. And so we have the same dynamics in our pews, in our congregations, in our faith, where the only people talking about these issues are people of color, and then we are made to feel like we're troublemakers, we're always complaining, we don't like anything, we are always the ones that have to be making people feel uncomfortable, and it's like, we're uncomfortable anyway. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that if we are meant to have a goal of harmonious life together, then we all have to be made to be uncomfortable first, and then we can work together to create harmony. It's not a situation of, well, I'm already harmonious, and you're bringing me into this depths of being uncomfortable. And, you know, it goes back to what Carlton was saying about giving a privilege. There is a privilege in that tranquility. There is a privilege in the comfort of not having to worry about these things. And that's what we're asking folks. We're asking our fellow UUs that are not in this position of feeling it on a day-to-day basis to examine in their lives, in their congregations, in their sermons, in their interactions with UUs of color, is examining the privilege they have and their comfort of not dealing with these issues, and what that can look, how different that can look if they challenge that.
Kenny, you trying to get in there?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the reasons I went back and forth about, do I put this on Facebook, do I not, I wanted to respect the experience that our youth, all of our youth had. And I decided to because what would have been really amazing, and there are, is that had there been a white adult leader in the space who could have just said, why are we so obsessed with sticking to the plan, or with like everybody each making sure that no youth of color, no white, no youth at all feels uncomfortable? But what when if everybody you're trying to get everybody to agree, you know, that you're just really lifting up, there's one white person in the room who feels uncomfortable, we're all going to not do this. Is that really what we're setting up? And had there been a white adult in the space who could have said that or shown folks that, because our white youth leaders were trying as hard as they could and then some to build something that felt, you know, felt good for everybody. And then, you know, so it fell on Jamil and Marcus and myself to assure folks that we're not, that we want whatever we end up deciding to do tomorrow as adults, we're going to keep our youth as safe as possible. I wouldn't, you know, I'm in Black Lives Matter Denver. I wouldn't be suggesting we join this if I thought it was going to be super unsafe, right? I predicted the police would block the streets off for this huge march. They're not going to arrest thousands of people, including hundreds of white teenagers. I mean, there'd be like, that'd be the greatest thing that would ever happen to the Black Lives Matter movement if that happened, right? So like, they're not going to do that. But the folks in the room didn't believe me until it happened, right? And so this way in which some folks, I said on Facebook that sometimes the work adults of color do is undervalued and sometimes it's overvalued. Oh my gosh, so-and-so is just so amazing and blah, 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 right? But a lot of times it was clear over the weekend that until folks saw that the three of us adults of color, we really knew what we were talking about and we really knew what we were doing, that they didn't think we, you know, had what it takes. And that just, it just was so... but again, in the end, through the leadership of our youth of color telling white folks, we need you, we love you, and sometimes you are super in our way, that brought our community to a place that it's never been before here in the Mountain Desert area. So it was, in the end, it was really cool because we lived in the tension and we lived in the conflict.
Amen. Congratulations. I hope that will ripple out into the wider youth and adult world. I was just going to mention, I preached MLK Day, and what I did was use some of the letter that the white people wrote to King that inspired the letter from the Birmingham jail, and talked about how much I could see myself in it, and I could see my culture in it, and part of me that's always going peace, peace. I could really play both sides of it, because I want comfort and I want privilege and I have this child who will not stop pulling me out, and so I could really kind of give a lot of people space. And while some people told me later that people next to them stomped out angry, which was fine, a lot of people really, I think the white people, you know, I know all that from the inside, that, and I just talked about how that theology of peace is really a theology of injustice, and is that really where we want to be? And anyway, those words, I hadn't looked at the white people's words for a while. I use Birmingham jail all the time, but they are so exactly what people are saying on Facebook today. I mean, just day after day after day. And so anyway, there are a lot of ways that Dr. King's legacy, sadly, is just word for word. You know, they're saying, wait, be peaceful until the courts have their say. I mean, it's just word for word. So, I love the way that the legacy is being pulled in. Joanna, you want to say what you're typing here?
Just an FYI, since we're getting to the end of our hour, the Hotzclaw sentencing is about to happen for those who have been following that case. That is the officer who raped 13 women, all of them African American. And if you want to follow along with that, if you follow hashtag Hotzclaw on Twitter, there are people in the courtroom reporting on that.
and a nod to Katie Cartman, who's been watching it for me on Twitter and told me she'd tell me if any decision came in, but I should have understood that my panelists here would also be watching that. And I see, Leslie, that you are too, of course. So we're coming to the end. I want to ask our guests for final thoughts and words.
I actually don't have a final thought about what we've been talking about, but I did want to mention, you quickly mentioned Flint earlier before we came on air, and I just want to mention that I'll be going to Flint on Sunday. Ferguson Response will be, we're going to be targeting two communities that have been left out of the donation cycle. No water has been brought to public housing at all. All of the donations that have come, none have been brought to public housing, and the inmates in Flint are still 100% on contaminated water. So they're drinking, bathing, and using solely contaminated water with no filter. So we'll be heading there Sunday to focus on those two forgotten communities and bringing some relief there. I expect it'll be continued, as often these marginalized communities are not serviced in the the nonprofit industrial complex and ways that people get donations. So I just wanted to lift that up, and you can go to FergusonResponse.org for information on that and donating to help us in our efforts there.
Go ahead, can you go?
Okay. Yeah, what I was going to say was that our youth of color in the Unitarian Universalist Church, they don't need your praise, they don't need your sort of paternal, I don't even know the best word, but what they need is your support and your guidance and your willingness to sit in uncomfortable moments. That when they share how they feel about white folks, except that they're also probably saying they love you, they just need something different. And I know that can be true for not every person of color in our faith, but as folks go on their journeys, I think support is needed more than just words that can sort of have the intent of praise, but often can feel like silencing. So that's going forward. That's what I'm going to be really pushing and working on.
And coming out of the big Congregational Life meeting last week that was held in Boston, where we had six people of color who now are serving on our National Congregational Life staff, one of the things that was surfacing is the need to be able to affirm that which has happened in the past while also continuing to move forward in the present. I know that there's been some pushback against Dr. King's legacy in some ways, or even against nonviolence as a method of achieving it. And I'd like to say that there's still ways that we can move forward and learn from that legacy, but also move beyond some of the things that were very much a part of his legacy, which included respectability politics, the idea that if we just presented our best selves and showed up in our Sunday clothes, that people would sympathize and come along. And we've come to see that that's not always the case. So while we look at the past and embrace aspects of the legacy and learn from Dr. King, let's also continue to look at boldly at the realities of our present time.
Amen, including all of the women and queers and trans people and just the wonderful mix of leaders now that we're not in the center back 50 years ago. Thank you so much. It's always, there's always so much going on. There's so many things we didn't get to talk about, but I know that all of the videos that we've been doing with Black Lives Matter UU have been featured by Standing on the Side of Love as part of the 30 Days of Love. You can go back and watch the old ones, and they're still timely. They're not 50 years old. Next week we'll have Keith Cron here talking about the search process. And any other last words from anyone?
Yeah, this whole thing made me think of the closing words that so many of us use on Christmas Eve, Howard Thurman's words about, and now the work of Christmas begins. And I think of that every Martin Luther King day of, like, the day after, on that Tuesday, of, like, and now the work of Dr. King begins. We can all be nice on that Monday and do great things and do wonderful stuff, but really the real work is the work that follows afterwards.
All right. Thanks so much. See you next time.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.